this is a good recording, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Stop. Right on.
Good morning and welcome to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. Good morning, Chief Calvin. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good, Earl. How are you?
Fine, man. Yesterday was 49 degrees in Milwaukee, man. Tied a record.
Yesterday was.
Yes.
Yeah, this morning it was snowing on my way out here a little bit.
Well, by now, you know who that voice is. That's Sandy Williams, my co-host. Good morning to you, Sandy. How you doing?
I'm doing all right.
I watched the weather person this morning say that winter is officially two-thirds done with.
Well, today, you know what today is?
What?
Groundhog Day.
Is it today?
Punxsutawney comes out, looks for his shadow or her. I don't know whether this groundhog was gender neutral or what. Today's the day.
And saw the shadow.
I haven't heard.
Yeah.
I haven't heard.
I heard him say he saw the shadow, which means, you know, it's going to be a quicker or an earlier summer.
Earlier spring.
Spring.
Well.
Sandy, next week, 350s on the docket.
50 degree days?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I'm glad I didn't lay down that ice rink, I'll tell you.
350 degree days. We're going to be 45 and above.
Welcome to
all the way through
welcome
next
to Charlotte.
Week. Well, but you know, Sandy, it's not just Wisconsin, it's all over the nation, the warm temperatures.
Yeah. It's just not like it used to be.
No, it may never ever be like that again, right?
Well, like you know, that's the same. It's true about everything, right? Nostalgia. You can look back and think warmly about it, but you can't recreate it. You can't do it over.
Well, Sandy, I know about you, but I'm not upset about it not being 40 below with the wind chill.
Yeah, I think that's proof of manhood. You know. Get out there in that raw, cold weather and prove what you got, you know?
Hey Calvin, did you hear Sandy?
I heard him, and I guess I'll pass on the man again.
Well, in fact, manhood's that's thin ice to even use that term, but it's definitely a test. It's a test of character, let's put it that way.
You know, Sandy, I remember... Here we go, people. Here they go again.
I remember.
Well, you know, Sandy, New Year's, when I was a young person going out on New Year's, it was always well below zero. It was cold.
Yeah.
You know, and so you got in and you knew it was going to be cold. January's always like the coldest month of the year. We only had one bad week in January, right? The others were... 30 and above.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we had about three and a half weeks of real winter so far. The rest of it's all been something much more like Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yeah.
And it looks like we're returning to the same thing. So, yeah, our climate is definitely changing. And without arguing about cause, simply saying, yeah, the climate is definitely changing.
You know, Sandy, it's... It is something that I'll tell you. I'm not crying crocodile tears. We're just about where we should be with the snow. You know, last year we kind of had a drought, right? I mean, during the spring and during the summer we had drought.
But
we've kind of caught up.
Well, we should. You know. I wonder if you do weather on the radio. Whether you have to be quite as dynamic a person, you know, when you talk here, we're talking weather and we're sort of moving along slowly.
Yes, slogging.
We're slogging through the weather here, Earl. I think I'm done with the weather.
Right, man. Well, I'm not done with it, and not until 3 days of 50 next week.
Okay.
Anyway, Sandy, we got a lot to talk about. I want to go here, man. You know, I'm a guy who goes to some Brewer games, right?
Yeah.
I've gone to Brewer games in the past. And every time I go to the Brewer game and Burns is on the mound, you can rest assured the Brewers have a better than 50-50 chance that they're going to win the game because he's going to hold the other team to one or two runs, three at the most.
Yeah, I think I noticed his ERA was 3.23, which is low in today's world. And he's got, you know, he was an all-star, I think, last year. He's been a multiple-year all-star.
I remember when they brought Corbin Burns. Well, we're not sports broadcasters. Can we talk about sports?
We can. And okay. However, I will tell you, baseball, I gave up on baseball when the Braves went to Atlanta, pretty much. Although I have to say that I did go to a couple of World Series games back in the 80s when they were, you know, so I'm a fair weather baseball fan.
But you know who Corbin Burns is?
I do know who Corbin Burns
is. Corbin Burns is one of the best pitchers in baseball.
Yeah. I noticed they trade him and they get a prospect and a 24th round draft choice. I couldn't figure this out.
Well, Sandy, they were concerned about how much money they would have to pay him.
Yeah, they didn't ask me before the trade. I know that.
So my point to you, Sandy, is they just got a half a billion dollars from the state, right?
Well, that all goes into the stadium.
Yeah, but it means that they're not going to have to put as much there. They gives them some added capital that they really could have paid.
Well, yeah, Burns. Yeah. Presumably, the improved stadium increases their revenue stream. And I don't know. I suspect the Brewers have lately been a low payroll team. I don't think they lose money year to year.
No,
I'm not sure. And the article I read after reading this confounding news about getting a prospect and a 24th round draft choice was that the general manager of the Brewers is all about winning a championship this year.
So oh, come on.
Somehow this deal was supposed to smack of aggressive general managing so that they're going to really be improving the team. I didn't get it.
Not by getting rid of Corbin Burns, okay? You don't improve your team. And I can tell you, I'm a guy probably go to 10 Brewer games a year. So, you know.
Is that to, like, get over insomnia?
Hey, so when friends are asking, hey, Earl, can you, and we, the radio station has Brewers on in our lineup. And so, you know, we go to the game from time to time. And so, Sandy, what it amounts to is, every time I go to a game, it's 1-0.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
2-1.
The insomnia thing. Yeah. You can get over it there.
And they go ahead.
Well, baseball, you know, is an odd sport because it's all about athleticism and it's not so much about hustle or conditioning, although it's become more of that. But I always felt like baseball on the playground was just an opportunity for embarrassment, basically.
Yeah, well, so they would always say, oh, what a great game, 1-0. It was a great game. And I walk out. I won 14-12. To me, that's a great game. Offense.
I went to my most memorable game was going to see Earl Wilson pitch a no-hitter for the Braves. And I sat right behind the catcher. I had some friend who had these great seats. So I watched a no-hitter, which is like, that's no runs, okay? That was like, the game was 1-0. But it was an exciting game.
So sad.
No hitters are exciting.
I remember the Warren Spahn, Lou Burdette, Hank Aaron, Rico Cardi.
But you don't remember Earl Wilson?
Never. He couldn't have been around during their time.
Yeah, he was. He pitched. He was on the pitching staff.
With Warren Spahn and Lou Burdette and those guys?
Yeah, yep.
Oh, okay.
I'll look him up just to make sure my memory isn't faulty.
He must have been a fringe guy. Let's go to Steven from Green Bay. I don't know what Steven is young enough to know about the Brewers. Hey, good morning to you, Steven. How you doing, man?
Good morning.
Can you believe we're talking baseball, man? Go ahead.
No, I can't, but it's refreshing. You know, sometimes it's okay to talk about something that's not so, you know, negative. With that being said, when I saw the trade come across my phone last night, you know that scene from The Mask where, you know, his jaw drops to the floor and his tongue comes out of his mouth?
Yeah,
that was kind of me when I saw that they traded Corbin Burns. And then I saw what they got back for him, and I guess I just don't understand it. You know, Corbin Burns isn't the first high, you know, high profile pitcher we let go this year. We let go of Woody as well. Now, I understand
Woody
have been able to play this year anyways. But yeah, I just don't understand how they think they're making our team better with getting rid of 50% of our pitching staff and two studs on the team. Right now, and this is just my prediction, I don't think the Brewers are making it anywhere this year, to be honest with you, and it hurts me to say that.
Well, there are two things. Number one, they're not making the team better. They're making it cheaper. And then at the same time, they don't have – who was the coach they had all those years, man? How can I forget the coach's name?
Let me just intersect. I've done my research now.
Okay, go ahead.
This no-hitter pitcher was Jim Wilson.
Jim Wilson. Okay.
1954.
Well, 1954.
I was sitting I was a 10-year-old kid sitting there in the behind the catcher thinking it was great.
Sandy, 1954 was the date of my birth. I mean, the year of my birth.
I know. We both just revealed.
Why am I forgetting the Brewers? Coach for all those years. He's no longer there.
Craig Counsell.
Yeah,
there you go.
So, Steven, you know it's going to be different because Craig Counsell is not going to be there.
You know who is the manager now, though, is the guy who managed Craig Counsell at Notre Dame University.
Really?
Yeah, the guy that they hired by Counsell because Counsell knew and liked him because he was Counsell's manager coach at Notre Dame.
So, Sandy, I think it's safe to say that guy won't make as much money as Counsell was making.
No, I think that's right.
So they're cutting payroll.
Here's a fact to it. I grew up in a house in Whitefish Bay that Craig Counsell lives in right now. So I am connected to baseball in that particular manner.
And he'll probably stay there because he's in Chicago.
Yeah, I think he probably will.
Yeah. All right. 844-967-2789. Sandy, what are we going to be doing?
Well, I think, you know, when we come back, I think we should, we'll shake things up a little bit. That's what we'll be doing.
All right. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Show as always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with my co-host Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, before we get into some other things, you and I and our radio station is going to be engaged in the Republican convention in Milwaukee, as well as we'll be doing some live stuff from the Democratic convention in Chicago. Really kind of excited about being around all that action.
It's an exciting thing. I've been to one. I was at a Democratic convention when I worked for Pat Lucey, and he was trying to be vice president of the United States. And the guy got pretty involved in the processes on the floor, et cetera. It's different.
Lot of action, huh?
Yeah, a lot of action. It's something like the commodity exchange, you know.
Well, but you got to figure that was back then, and this massiveness of it today probably is just.
Yeah, you know, the conventions back then, there was far less that it was totally resolved at the time. And so, yeah, the candidate was pretty well pegged, but there was still a lot of business to be done at the convention. These conventions these days are pretty much eyewash. They're staged to try and create a political impression.
Sandy, I want to, we've talked about it. We're going to continue to talk about it because it continues to be an issue. And that's the border. And so Republicans are going to have to, Sandy, they're caught between a rock and a hard place.
Well, you know, they're at the leadership of the Republican Party appears to be trying to do the right thing, particularly at the Senate level. And they've apparently reached a negotiation. Schumer indicated that they had resolved the major issues. The negotiators on the Republican side and the independent who was negotiating have all indicated, yeah, we got an agreement. And it looks to me like it accomplishes almost everything that the conservatives have wanted to have accomplished at the border. They're going to stop this program of what's called catch and release, which basically means a parole without supervision and surveillance. The new bill would require that anyone who comes across the border and is awaiting their hearing will be under constant surveillance by the government. Now, establishing a breakpoint, more than 5,000 encounters in a day, and the president can shut down the border till they can catch up. And a couple of other things. You know, the sticking points appear to be twofold. One, Donald Trump and the hard right and the Republicans, particularly in the House, are saying we don't want to pass anything during Biden because it'll neutralize this issue. We'd rather have this issue to run against Biden than we would have the issue resolved for the American people. That's number one. Number two, there are some Republicans who appear to be reluctant to fund it. Okay,
and House Republicans.
House Republicans. And the fact is that everyone has known that one of the reasons we have the problem is the agency responsible for handling all of this stuff is underfunded and understaffed. And so in order to catch up to the problem, it's going to require material funding and as well to, for instance, put 1 million people under surveillance or whatever the number is of these people awaiting their hearings is a very expensive process.
I was listening the other day, and I forgot where it was, and there was some Republicans who were saying people will be complaining if there's X amount of dollars available. We'd have to take that money from somewhere else to fund it. How would people like it if that money came out of Social Security or Medicare to fund the border? And I'm like, really?
Well,
those are the places.
Well, interestingly, maybe what it could come out of is not giving the tax break that's part of this new child tax credit that involves additional tax reduction rights for corporations. I mean, people who talk about not having enough money need to be worried about pursuing further revenue cuts. Because, of course, that means we have less money. And furthermore, you know, talking about taking it out of Social Security is sort of the same thing as when we have a government shutdown and the first thing we shut down is every park that people like going to. Or, you know, so you try to create political pressure by picking and choosing the things you take money out of to be the things that are particularly popular.
You know, Sandy, I don't know if it's just that you and I focus on things that to me make sense. To me, when you hear somebody say we can't afford to do that, at the same time they're asking for increases in that military budget. Sandy, imagine the amount of money they're going to be pushing to the military because of what's happening in Israel, what's still happening in Ukraine, what's happening now, you know, with skirmish in the Middle East.
Jordan and Syria, yeah. I mean,
people don't know what's coming.
Well, I mean, that's the problem is that we don't tend to look at our whole budget like a family and say, okay, we're spending a lot of money here. Can we cut it? Can we cut money here so we can spend it over here where we really need to? And we just talk about things singularly. And so, you know, we've got Lindsey Graham jumping up and down saying we ought to retaliate directly against Iran. That would be an potentially enormously expensive venture, number one. And number two, I'm not sure it's at all proportionate to the situation. Like I talked about on Tuesday, we're a massive arms seller, and so is Iran. And if we decide we're going to attack Iran every time some munitions that they sell get deployed in a manner that we don't like, that's going to be a serious problem.
All right. Hang in there. We're going to talk about many things on our return. We're going to continue to talk about the border bill, child tax credit, the skirmish that continues in the Middle East, and we're going to continue to do that with Sandy Williams. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with my co-host, Sandy. So, Sandy, it's Black History Month, and so we're going to be doing a lot of things on the show this month, having a lot of professors and grills and other people who will be able to tell some stories about Black history in the state of Wisconsin. And so there are many people who don't understand in many rural areas that they were refuges for slaves through the Underground Railroad. Wisconsin was one of the main states that provided refuge for runaway slaves.
Yeah, Wisconsin was had an active Underground Railroad, and what's interesting is the Underground Railroad in Wisconsin was primarily rural communities. Wisconsin was primarily rural. I mean, Milwaukee and was probably the only urban center at the time. And, you know, in fact, I remember I had a son who worked in a restaurant in Middleton, Wisconsin, and was sitting there eating in the basement there, and there was a placard describing how it was the site of an Underground Railroad safe house. And these exist all around Wisconsin. And, you know, the Wisconsin's had a very progressive, its rural community was very progressive at the time and had an activist sense about itself because, you know, these slaves were all subject to being taken by bounty hunters. And they were at risk to be seized and taken back, and the people who were harboring them were at risk as well. And so, you know, it was a time of great both heroism and danger. It was a little bit like the Jews of Germany and people being saved and at that point the people who supported the slaves were taking the same kind of risk.
You know, on this Monday, the 5th, I'm going to have the curator and owner of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society and Museum, Claiborne Benson, who's going to be with us. He knows that history. He knows the towns. He knows where it transpired. The people who he studied all of those things. And there's some parts of the state of Wisconsin that I'm sure people live in today, rural Wisconsin, who don't even know these things took place. The fact that in their towns, those people took the risk, and major risk at the time. You talked about bounty hunters.
Yeah, yeah.
These people were property of someone, and who got away, and so they hunted their property. They wanted to make sure they got their property back, and anybody who was harboring fugitives, you know, back then it kind of wasn't, you know, you call the police. It's kind of, you took care of this thing yourself, right?
Right. So, I mean, there was a great deal of risk associated with participating in the Underground Railroad, and there was a great deal of participation in it in Wisconsin.
Yeah. So, anyway, we're going to be talking about those things in the coming weeks and on the show. Sandy, I want to get to... I was looking at this thing with Ukraine. Last month, Russia lost more weaponry and soldiers than they did at any other time during the war, Sandy. I was kind of amazed.
Well, the Russians have adopted a strategy, at least as reported. Like I've said, you know, it's very hard to get truth and facts out of this whole Ukrainian conflict because both sides are providing information that is very propaganda driven. And I'm not sure how much third party unbiased observation is ongoing, but the Russians have adopted a strategy that's much more waves of warfare of that spend lives a great deal. And the Russians have always been known for that kind of warfare. That's one of the reasons they lost upwards of 25 million people during World War II, half of those being military, because of their style, which was essentially sending waves of men into gunfire to overwhelm the opponent. And, you know, they've conscripted lots of convicts in Russia, and this is known. And these convicts are spent in a manner that's probably different than they would normally be spending their military in terms of how they use them in warfare. So, yeah, there have been lots of casualties, but there's currently an assessment that the Russians have more capacity right now to fight than the Ukrainians based on the level of munitions and the level of manpower available. So, you know, my hope had been that there was enough losses being experienced on both sides that they would decide that it was time for a ceasefire.
Let me ask you, Sandy, it's been 2 years. I remember the first conversation you and I had about the invasion. And I don't think you even thought it would still be going at this point.
Well, I think the general assessment at the time was, first of all, in the first day or two, the assessment was that Russia would just overwhelm Ukraine, and that didn't happen. And when the war was in its third week, everyone said, holy cow, this thing's ongoing, and it looks like it's actually going to be more than just a short skirmish and a surrender. And now it's 2 years, and we're at a situation of great stalemate. The EU has just promised $54 billion to Ukraine. And the United States, if we can ever get this straightened out in the Senate, Biden is talking about a long-term $60 billion. So you've got there about $114 billion of money that's being promised to Ukraine, which ought to give Russia pause, because the $114 billion should give Ukraine the capacity to mount both a strong defense of itself and maybe in some offensive activity. Ukraine has currently been using its offensive weaponry in a way that reaches all the way up to St. Petersburg. They had drones that blew up some oil facilities in St. Petersburg, which is a long ways away from Ukraine, about 750 miles north.
Let me ask you, Sandy, because I remember you also saying, I can say years ago now, that this would be a point in time, you know, where this could slog on and on and on. We're kind of at a point where it's slogging on and on and on. Let me ask you, why hasn't there been diplomacy? Why can't we? Who's going to create the environment for diplomacy? Clearly, the two of them together, somebody has. And I thought China was the one who was going to be. We knew it wasn't going to be America, but I thought China would be the one that would have stepped in and tried to create the dialogue, at least.
Well, I think if China maintained independence from Russia in that process, they would have a shot at it. But I think right now, China and Russia have been pushed into being so close to one another on this kind of an issue that China probably isn't a fair broker of a peace, because they're basically viewed as probably doing Russia's bidding in the process. But, it all has to do with taking realistic positions associated with that area of Eastern Europe that has a lot of history behind it. And so Zelensky represents the right side of politics. I don't mean correct.
Right,
I mean he's right rather than left in terms of so the conservative wing in Ukraine is particularly adamant about not giving up any property and any geography whatsoever. That position probably would create a very long conflict, because I think Russia is pretty adamant about both Crimea and the Donetsk region, and some portions of that I think are undoubtedly going to have to be ceded to Russia to reflect some realities that at least Russia believes exist with respect to the history and the Russian character of those particular areas.
You know, Sandy, the American people aren't worried in the least about Ukraine. Others aren't worried about Ukraine. America can't broker the deal because it's too close to Ukraine. China can't broker the deal because it's too close.
Well, I think the United States is in a position to have a great deal of impact on the deal because we are so close to Ukraine. Ukraine is very dependent on us. And I think if we can both overtly promise Ukraine all the support they need to continue their conflict with Russia, and behind the scenes then exert influence on Ukraine to take an approach to negotiation that could result in a diplomatic settlement, I think we're in a position to do that. And I would guess that process is ongoing. And I would guess that process is what's prompting the $60 billion promise, so that the promise can be above on the horizon for Russia to look at, which could push them in the direction of negotiating a peace.
Sandy, there's no pressure from the American people because the American people aren't connected to what's going on in Ukraine.
Well, you can see that's the case because
right.
the Republican side has decided to back off from it, which means that we didn't care enough about it in the first place, which was, as you recall, was my problem with our whole policy in Eastern Europe with respect to the NATO invitation and the rest of it, that do we really care enough? Because you understand that if Ukraine is a part of NATO, this invasion would have required that the United States, under Article 5 of NATO, do everything we would do to defend ourselves, to defend that geography, which would have put American boots on the ground and would have put us in a direct conflict with Russia. I think that Ukraine is a lesson to us. And my concern about the lesson is that some people are calling those who ask questions about Taiwan or Ukraine as accusing them of being isolationists. There are some people who may possibly are isolationists. Trump is being described now as an isolationist. But there are others who are just asking that we have a rational approach to our international affairs, and that we stay internationally active, but active only in a way that reflects the direct interests of the United States.
So clearly, Sandy, I don't believe that the American people think that Ukraine has any correlation with our nation. And, you know, we don't, what are we getting from Ukraine? What happens in Ukraine, whether Ukraine is overrun by Russia, other than for people to say that we don't want to see, you know, innocent people, you know, being controlled. I don't think there's anything that you can say to the American people to make them think that this is something they should be concerned about.
Well, I think there are some.
Early on, they were.
Well, I think there are some who are trying to say this is the first domino and that this is the beginning of a World War III, that if Ukraine falls, next is Poland, and, you know, it's the whole domino thing. It's kind of the way we decided to fight in Vietnam. Vietnam was a communist domino, right? And if it fell, then who knew what was next? The actual answer was there was nothing next. You know, I think that I'd be interested in what our callers would think about the issue of Ukraine and the general formulation of American foreign policy, because we end up now looking like we're having sort of a schism in Washington between Republicans and Democrats about something like Ukraine. And at the same time, those same people are saying, attack Iran, but maybe let's not fund Ukraine. You know, it's an interesting dichotomy.
All right, listen.
Maybe, you know, I think that we should ask our callers to think about that while we move on through this next segment.
Well, news and weather up next on the Earl Ingram Show. Oh, no. Okay.
I think Roy was albino. It was an interesting, he had an interesting physical kind of challenges, but a great voice.
But if you look at, 844-967-2789, you're back, we're back. And you know, Sandy, Roy Orbison, you look at him, you looked at him, and he had these Coke bottle glasses, right? And he just was out of character for a guy who was an entertainer, right?
Right.
Kind of a big guy.
Yeah.
And, but there was something strange about him, man.
Well, I think the syndrome is that called albinism, and albinism involves a lack of pigment in your eyes. And so you have to wear pink.
Oh, that's why he
glasses. He wore the glasses, right. I believe, to protect his eyes from the circumstance.
Sun, right.
It also frequently comes with eyes that move rapidly. But you know, he had sort of two comings. He had his original career, and then he sort of went dark for a while, and then he came back as a big deal.
All right, let's go to the phone lines. And Susan from Kenosha. Good morning to you, Susan. You hear the job by Roy Orbison?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say you had a crush on Roy Orbison. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I do. But, I mean, I love his music, but this wasn't the reason why I was calling, but you're so funny. You're so cute.
All right, go ahead.
I kind of disagree a little bit with Sandy. I'm sorry. I mean, I know that you know far more about this than I do. But I believe that the Ukrainian people deserve their country, their own country. If they have to give up a little bit of land for Russia, so be it. But I do feel that they should be allowed to control their own country. I think that Putin and the Russians, I think this is just a political play, and they like that port. There's a lot of wheat and other things that Ukraine offers the world. But I do believe that we should support Ukraine and their people. I kind of think back to, and, you know, I read a lot. I think back about the Jewish people in Germany and what was done to them. And when I see Putin, it brings back those kind of thoughts. And I just don't want to see a country controlled by an authoritarian government. That's my last word.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the call, Susan. Sandy?
Well, I definitely think that Ukraine is entitled to its sovereignty as well. I don't think that was that's never been the purport of what I've had to say. But, you know, the question was whether Ukraine should be a part of NATO and whether Ukraine should lean to the east or lean to the west in terms of its dealings, because the world is set up with these sort of areas of power, at least in terms of power politics. And so my issue has been whether the United States has properly recognized the realities that exist in Eastern Europe, and not recognizing those realities might have been part and parcel of what initiated the conflict.
Let me ask you, Sandy, because I don't know if people are really giving it a lot of thought, but let's look at what Joe Biden is dealing with and the impact that it may have on people who are going to vote yay or nay. The Middle East issue, the Ukrainian issue. These are major issues that are going on that at different points in time would have been so visible to the American people. You know, different points in our history where wars and those kind of things play one of the major roles in deciding and determining who you are going to vote for, right?
Yeah.
It's not the case this time, is it?
Well, you know, the question is, you know, we've got a candidate who's running who would say that if I were in office, none of this would happen. I'm not sure that's the case at all. I think if someone is in office who's an isolationist, isolationism is going to let those things happen. And the difference is that he's not going to care about them, right? We're not. An isolationist would tell us to turn our back. Don't worry about that. It's not an area of our particular interest. And, you know, to some extent in some areas of the world that might be closer to right, okay, in terms of looking at the world and deciding that there are areas of the world in which the United States' direct interest is not implicated, and so we can't implicate all of our resources. But we've had very measured responses. Our response in Ukraine has been quite measured in terms of it being only munitions and money. We've been very careful about getting directly involved with it. Our response to the Iranian issue has so far been temperate, okay? And so I think people ought to sit back and reflect on the extent to which whoever is resident of the White House could have had an impact on what it is that's happening. And I'm confident that the Israeli issue, even though Trump would say that it would never have happened on his watch, that in fact, he being in office and being very tight with Netanyahu would have had no impact whatsoever on the question of whether it would have happened. Then the question is, what would we have done after it happened?
Let me ask you, Sandy, because maybe war is one thing when if you're giving money or giving munitions, it's another thing altogether if your countrymen are involved in the wars. And because our countrymen aren't involved in those wars, maybe people don't see it the same way.
Well, I mean, yeah, but, you know, we sustained a war in Afghanistan for 20 years. I just think that we tend to ignore war situations like that unless they are really hitting us at home. And by that, I mean lots of people at home. Currently, with our volunteer military, we end up with and the limited number of casualties that are experienced, we tend to have a great deal of tolerance for it, I guess.
All right, so 30 things Joe Biden did as president you might have missed. That's where we're going to be going, Sandy. But up next, news and weather.
Okay. That's the way it must be. Okay. I guess I'll go on home. It's late.